We'll begin with a short answer segment called Political Password, followed by questions from our media panelists, who you'll meet in a few minutes. Third, we'll take questions from our studio audience. Then, after a short break, we'll be back with another round of questions from both our citizens and our media panel. Following the questions, each candidate will be given the opportunity to make a closing statement. I ask that our candidates stick closely to the limits that have been set for responses in each segment so that we have the opportunity to include as many questions as possible. Drawing by lot prior to the debate determined which candidate will answer first. The order of responses for questions tonight will be first Jesse Ventura, then Norm Coleman, and Skip Humphrey. We'll alternate from then on. We'll begin now with Political Password. Each response will be limited to 30 seconds. Mr. Ventura, you go first. Your political password is graduation standards.
Graduation standards, of course, are the new law. They've been passed by the legislature, so we have to follow them. It's that simple until the legislature changes those standards in any manner. And I think that what we need to do is very quickly, I think that some of them were applied too fast to the teachers, but I think the teachers will be catching on, and we need to form a task force of both citizens, teachers, school board people to look at these standards very closely, determine which ones are good and which ones are not.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Mr. Coleman, your 30-second response to graduation standards.
Parents have a right to know that their kids are learning, that they are being educated. And graduation standards give them that right. We know there's some accountability. The problem I have is with the system we've developed to get there. And I really want to go back to parents and teachers at the local level. I don't want the state dictating the content, how you get there. Yes, we want high standards, but at the local level, parents and teachers should be involved to develop the kind of curriculum that helps us and our kids reach those very high standards.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Humphrey, your response to graduation standards.
Graduation standards are the benchmark for the performance of students. We need to have those in place so that we know when students are performing well and when they may be falling behind so that we can help them catch up. But the key here is to have involvement with parents and teachers at the local level so that we can indeed have those graduation standards work and work locally in those schools, in the classroom. That's what bottom line it's all about.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Political password number two is HMOs. And Mr. Coleman, your response first.
Well, the real issue is health care. How are we going to ensure adequate health care for Minnesotans? First and foremost, Minnesotans want to have the opportunity to choose their doctor. And whatever system we have with it, we got to make sure that Minnesotans have that right. I will have an ombudsman in my Department of Health to make sure that Minnesotans want to have the right to choose their doctor. And if they're not getting access to the services they need, then we will respond. People want access, they want to choose their doctor, they want quality, and they want affordability. And we should be working with them to get there.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Humphrey, the password goes to you now, HMOs.
With regard to our HMOs, we need to make sure that the patient, you, and your doctor can make that decision, not someone in the back room of an insurance company. The reality is that all too often that's the kind of decision that's being made. As your governor, I will work with HMOs and with patients and with other providers to see that doctors and patients have that opportunity to make those decisions. That's what's critical, particularly also to make sure that we have decent health care for our senior citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Ventura, your 30-second response to HMOs.
First of all, again, it should be the doctors and the people in medicine, not the insurance companies, dictating what's going on. I think also we as private citizens deserve the same type of health care as what the career politicians are getting these days. Their health care is outstanding. And I think they should match up one way or the other. Either ours need to rise up to theirs or theirs need to come down to ours. And again, you should be able to choose your doctor and have a relationship with that doctor, not be changing month to month to a different doctor with all the paperwork involved.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Our final political password is Minnesota campaign finance reform. And Skip Humphrey has the first 30-second response.
Well, number one, I think Minnesota has been a leader in campaign finance reform, but we need to go much further. We need to have finance reform that embraces not only the hard dollars, so-called hard dollars, but the soft dollars. We ought to have the kind of containment that limits the amount of dollars that can be expended so that we have a fair balance and a fair opportunity to hear from all major parties.
Thank you. Mr. Jesse Ventura, Minnesota campaign finance reform.
First of all, you lead by example. Jesse Ventura accepts no PAC money whatsoever. Jesse Ventura is not owned by special interest groups. My two opponents can't say that. They're not leading by example. They're going out there. They're not setting an example to reform campaign finance. They're exploiting it for what it is today. November 3rd is no longer an election. It's an auction to the highest bidder, and that's what you have happening today in the world of politics with the professional politicians from both parties.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. The final response to the political password goes to Mr. Norm Coleman.
I think our presence here tonight is a demonstration that campaigns are not auctions to the highest bidder. We need to find a better way of making sure that the public can hear from the candidates and doing it more than in 30-second sound bites. If we could work that out, I think we'd be better served. We've made some stride in campaign finance reform. I don't think it's the issue of the decade, but the issue should be how can we communicate to you, the voters, so you get to know who we are and what we stand for. If we can do more forums like this, I think we'd all be well served.
We will turn now to questions from our media panelists. Providing those questions will be Jim Newman of WDSC-TV and Minnesota Public Television's Newsnight Minnesota program. Michelle Lee is news anchor at News 6 Television in Duluth. And Jeff Passelt is news anchor with KMSP-TV, Minnesota 9 News in the Twin Cities. Each candidate is asked to provide a one-minute response to a question from our media panel, and if a follow-up question is necessary, that candidate will have an additional 30 seconds to reply. The order of questions to the candidates will again be rotated throughout this portion of the debate. We'll begin now with Mr. Jim Newman, who has a question first going to Mr. Jesse Ventura. Jim?
Well, gentlemen, when I learned that I was going to be part of this panel, I started asking my friends around northeastern Minnesota, I mean, how did they identify you? Mr. Humphrey, son of Hubert, Attorney General, Mr. Norm Coleman, Mayor of St. Paul, Jesse the Body Ventura. Up here, you're still known mostly as a professional wrestler. Professional wrestler, combination of strength and showmanship, not a bad preparation for a political career. With that in mind, I'm asking, what special skills and techniques did you learn as a professional wrestler that would make you a good governor for the state of Minnesota?
Well, first of all, I've had a lot more to my career than just simply being a professional wrestler. I also served in the United States military. I'm the only veteran who stands before you today who not only talks the talk but walks the walk when it comes time to serving your country. So I have the experience of being a veteran for 4 years. Yes, my professional wrestling career helped because I think it makes me much more comfortable in front of cameras. I'm able to perform that way. I've also been an actor. And everyone likes to forget, even in the opening, I am former mayor Jesse Ventura. So I have 4 years of experience as mayor of Brooklyn Park, a city of almost 58,000 people, around the sixth, I believe, the sixth largest city in the state, where we had real problems, just like any other mayor does, of crime, taxes, and everything the like. So I know I varied off the pro wrestling thing a little bit, but I want people to know also that I am not a professional politician, that I've spent my life earning my living in the private sector, and that's what I bring forth is a private sector perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Jim? You have a question now for Mr. Norm Coleman.
Mr. Coleman, your experience as mayor of St. Paul, what are the one or two most important things that you learned as mayor that you hope to take into the governor's office?
First, Jim, I have governed. I have governed, and I am the only one standing up there who has governed and cut taxes. Every year that I've been in office, I've cut taxes. The only one standing up here who can say that they have cut taxes, cut bureaucracy, and helped create jobs. More than 8,000 new jobs in the capital city. Capital city, by the way, is much like Duluth. It's a working town with a working ethic. Folks concerned about the future, but I have governed. And having governed, have made the tough decisions and taken a city that many said was on its knees, and it's now on its feet. And again, by doing the simple things, by cutting taxes, cutting regulation, in the end, inspiring hope and confidence in people. We've got a riverfront that's developed now. There's $1 billion worth of new development in the core downtown. And again, thousands more jobs. In addition to that, I also bring to experience the only one here who has prosecuted criminals. Public safety isn't an abstract thing to me. It's not a philosophical thing. I've looked in the eyes of victims. I know how important it is. And as a mayor, we have instituted both tough enforcement of the big stuff and the little stuff, graffiti, truancy.
Thank you for your
time. And Mr. Humphrey, years spent as Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, does that qualify you to become governor?
Well, I think you have to go back before that. First and foremost, I'm a father of three children. I've had to deal with family issues of having children grow up. I think that's most important. Secondly, I've had the opportunity to have a private practice for more than 12 years, so I've had to balance budgets in a private business as well as deal with the issues in the public arena. But when it comes to the public arena, serving not only as a state senator and balancing budgets, cutting taxes, lowering the bureaucracy, I've also had the opportunity to take on the tough fights for the people of Minnesota, to battle and succeed against big tobacco, to see that we make the parents that are not paying their child support pay, to initiate the efforts to see that we have a gang strike force. I'm very proud to have the backing of the rank and file police officers. They know who can get the job done. I think all of those kind of qualities pulled together with working with people in a team will allow me to be a good governor for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. The next question to the candidates comes from Michelle Lee and goes first to Mr. Norm Coleman.
Mr. Coleman, in recent months, cheap foreign steel has literally flooded the U.S. market. As a result, Iron Range mining companies are threatening cutbacks and layoffs. If you were elected as our governor, what would you do to assist these Northland employers and their employees compete?
I think Minnesota Steel, and by the way, we are going to be facing the same problem in the wood products industry and paper. What we need is we need an advocate. We need that's what it's about. Someone who can stand. I can't control it here, but I can tell you I will stand with the steel companies. I will stand with the forest products industry. And Washington's got to do it. We had a president, by the way, who needs to be there and make sure that there is fair and free trade. And we're not getting it. We have dumping of agricultural products coming across our borders. We need a very strong advocate. I will be there. In addition, by the way, to be the advocate to stop the dumping, I will be there to grow the forest industry, grow the steel industry through common sense environmental regulation. We do that, we can have full growth, full opportunity, but I will be that kind of advocate that Minnesota needs.
Okay, thank you. The same question to Mr. Humphrey. Would you like me to read it out?
No, I think I understand it. I've already taken direct action. I sent letters directly to the president. I visited directly with the vice president just last week. I am working closely with Jim Oberstar and the congressional delegation to see that we stop this steel dumping. They are destroying what is a very productive, very efficient industry that has done a good job both working with the companies and with steel workers to make it as efficient as it possibly can be. We need to make certain that we have fair trade as well as free trade. That's the bottom line. Now, in addition to that, we need to go beyond that. We need to look at value-added products. We need to look at direct reduction. We need to look at many of the other opportunities to see that our steel industry grows and reaches and is ready to go for the 21st century. As your governor, I'm going to work both with Congress and here at home with the workers and the companies to make sure that we have the best steel industry in the country.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Ventura, what about you? What would you do to help those Iron Range companies?
Well, of course, it goes to the federal government. And my experience there was when I was mayor of Brooklyn Park, we needed a highway badly, the Highway 610. I was sent out to Washington to try to procure $11 million so we could piecemeal it together on the transportation bill that year. Well, I went out there and got $37 million. I went out and got over three times what I was sent out there to get. and that highway is currently being built today. Also, we can see that NAFTA has been, I believe, a failure, you know, as part of that, and that was supported both by Democrats and Republicans with bipartisan support. We were told that was a great thing for all of us, and I think the results are starting to show through right now. Maybe Ross was right.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Jeff, you have our next question, which goes first to Mr. Humphrey.
Mr. Humphrey, I think I want to address education because clearly in one of the latest polls, it is the most important issue amongst the voting public in Minnesota. There is the Goals 2000 program that is being pushed. Many people are still in favor of the traditional approach and think that Minnesota always ranks high when it comes to education in our nation. If it isn't broke, don't fix it. What do you plan on doing when it comes to education, and also distinguishing between what happens in the inner city, in the suburbs, and also in the outstate, which are completely different settings for these schools and all of the situations that they have to deal with?
Education is the centerpiece. It always has been. It's been the successful point of our heritage, and it will be the opportunity point for our future. We absolutely have to start at the very earliest stages. We have to start in those early years between the ages of 0 and 5 and help support our families with good parenting skills, with the kind of early childhood education programs that are so important, with childcare. And that's why I propose an income tax credit that will help up to $1,000 per child in childcare so that they're learning by the time they get to kindergarten. We need to make sure that we have smaller class sizes in K through 12. But we also have got to make sure that every student that wants to go on beyond high school has those first 2 years at least the opportunity without economic barrier, and that's why I propose an income tax credit of at least $1,000, up to $1,000 per student. The bottom line is if we want a workforce that is ready to meet the global world economy in the 21st century, we need to have it highly trained, highly educated. We need a quality workforce.
Mr. Humphrey, Jeff would like to exercise that option to have 30 seconds more to follow up.
Yeah, I guess I want to deal more specifically with Goals 2000. There was a rally within the last week at the state capitol, a very large group of people showing up saying that they're against it. What do you do for those people that aren't crazy about this program?
I think we can have a full range of options within the public education system. We need to be able to have not only the tax cuts that support it, but we need to be able to make sure that we're not siphoning off dollars elsewhere so that we can have the full range of charter schools, the learning centers, all the rest of these kinds of options that we would that anyone would like to have in the public school system. If there's homeschooling, then fine, let's have that, but let's make sure that our students are ready for that 21st century. I don't have a problem with the Goals 2000. I think we need to make sure that we are working all the way through to see that we're meeting those obligations, though.
Mr. Ventura, I guess I'd like to know where you stand on the Goals 2000 situation, and that it is a bit of a hot potato when it comes to education.
Yes, it is. First of all, in Goals 2000, there is controversy. It was implemented too quickly. The teachers were not ready for it, but it is the law. It's there. What I want to see is a task force with local educators, parents, teachers, get together, find out what's working in it, find out what's not, and streamline it from there. You know, it's interesting, my two opponents talk so highly of education and educating the children, and yet we had a debate scheduled for Sunday in front of over 100 high school students who wanted to take part in the system, and my two opponents canceled out of that debate, would not let the kids see the political process in action or let them become a part of it. We also need neighborhood schools. We have to go back to neighborhood schools, and we have to go to smaller class sizes. Money has already been allocated, over $400 million for that. But again, loopholes in the law by professional politicians. The money's there, but it's being used for other things. I will get that money back to a 17-to-1 class size so that we can then really do education and have kids learning by the first grade knowing how to read.
Your time is up.
And Mr. Coleman, the same situation.
Yeah, Jeff, you know, the issue with Goals 2000, profile of learning, really the question of how do parents get involved in their kids' education? That's what this is about. That's what those folks were standing up there and saying, you know, the state has laid out a series of very prescriptive dictates, some of which some folks would call gobbledygook, group process and group thinking. And they're saying, some parents saying, we don't want that for our kids. And what we need to do is we talked about in that first questions, have high standards. Have very, very high standards. But then at the local level, if parents and teachers come together and say, here's how we want our kids to meet those standards. Jeff, if you do that, if you get parents involved, if you reward teachers who perform well, if we do the things we can to have smaller class sizes, and Jesse's right, money is allocated, but let it start going to the kids. And then we make sure that every child has a right to a quality education. Public school first and foremost, but homeschooling, religious school, we do that, we'll have kids ready to meet the challenges of the 21st century.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Jim, the next question is yours and goes first to Mr. Ventura.
Mr. Ventura, a recent poll commissioned by the Grand Rapids-based Blandin Foundation shows that half of rural Minnesotans fear that their communities don't have and will never have living wage jobs. For many people, Minnesota is still a dual economy with the Twin Cities in a relative boom mode and rural economies lagging far behind. Would you support aggressive state measures to revitalize rural economies, or should the marketplace decide?
Well, I support revitalizing the rural markets, but when you talk about living wage, that puts pressure on the independent business owner. Then you've got government dictating to him what he's going to pay an employee. Say he raises it $2, right? Guess what? 70 cents of that goes to create larger government because it's going to be taxed, 70 cents out of the $2. What I support is lowering taxes, lowering government regulation. You lower the, and to do that, you've got to lower the size of government. It's plain and simple. Government is like an internal combustion engine. As it grows, what is required? More gasoline, which is more taxes from us. We need to control government's growth. Take a look, $4 billion a surplus, Democrats and Republicans spent it. I was the only candidate that stood at the steps of the Capitol saying, give that surplus back. They turned around and bonded us to the tune of $1 billion. You add that up with a $23 billion budget, government grew 16% in 1 year. Democrat and Republican support.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura.
Mr. Coleman, are you next? If you are, jump right in.
I'll jump right in. Jesse, you're right. It is, you know, aggressive government action is aggressively cutting taxes. Aggressive government action is aggressively cutting bureaucracy and regulation that's killing business. You know, the hope for northern Minnesota, which is a natural resource-based economy, is being able to use its resources. I think you have more to fear from the Attorney General's E-team that took after Marvin Windows and caused jobs in this community. Marvin Windows expanding in North Dakota, expanding in the South. The way isn't a government-dictated wage. What it is we do the things which, by the way, I've done in St. Paul. You cut taxes, you cut regulation, you make sure that the streets in the community are safe, and you make sure your kids get a quality education. And you make sure then somebody in this community is a champion of multiple use, common sense, environmental protection. That's what you do. And if you do that, we will have a bright and prosperous economic future for northern Minnesota.
Mr. Humphrey, agree or disagree?
In order to have an expanding and growing economy in greater Minnesota, you have to take a look at some of the basic elements. First and foremost, we need to make sure we are strongly supporting our family farmers. That's the bedrock of so much of greater Minnesota's ability to grow and to have a sound economy. But there's much more going on beyond just the family farm and farming itself and agriculture. There's a lot of off-farm income. How do we make sure that we have the jobs that are available and an expansion of that economy? We make sure by making sure that we have quality public education. More than 90% of our kids in Minnesota are educated in the public schools, so we need to make sure that we're fully supporting that public education. We need to make sure that we have transportation that will get products to market and services available. We need to make sure we have good health care, and that's why the Humphrey Moe budget, of which we are the only team that has a budget, has set forth the opportunity for quality health care all throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Michelle Lee has the next question for our candidates, and it goes first to Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Coleman, my next question involves handgun permits. Do you believe the controls now in place should be relaxed or tightened, and why?
Two observations. First, you're not the only team with the budget. You're the only team with $5.5 billion of spending promises. You don't have a budget. You've got a list of spending promises, a program for every need. In regard to people protecting their safety, I believe that we need more uniformity in the laws today. Right now, depending on where you live, if you're in Fergus Falls and you walk in, you get a permit. If you're in another area, the chief of police, somebody will say no. I believe that, that competent Minnesotans who has a, who have a reasonable concern for their safety have a right to protect themselves, and I think we simply need more uniformity, more fairness in the law.
What does that mean, though, uniformity?
Well, what it means is that there's a single standard. Mm-hmm. That's a statewide law. As was proposed, by the way, there was an amendment, the Macklin Amendment, that, by the way, went before the Minnesota legislature, passed by a majority of Democrats and Republicans, really laid out that standard. Competent Minnesotans, in other words, if you have, you can't be a drug addict, can't be a felon. If you have to go through an NRA test, you have to actually be, and go through a period of earning a license, in effect. What bottom line is that if you have a reasonable concern for your safety, you should have a right to protect yourself and your family, and there are protections built into that law.
All right, time is up. Thank you very much. Mr. Humphrey, you, how about you? What do you think as far as the handgun permits? Are they relaxed enough or too tight? Or
we don't need any change in the handgun law. Mr. Coleman says we need a uniform standard. We have it, and it works. We don't need more loaded, concealed handguns at Miller Mall or anywhere else. That's ridiculous. It just seems to be outrageous that you would be walking along and not knowing who has the handgun and who doesn't. We have local control. Local sheriff, local police chiefs, they're the ones that are able to make those decisions upon the request. So there's an available resource, but we don't need to make any kind of changes. The reality is that since one of the reasons that I am endorsed by the rank and file police of this state is that they know that I will be there to work with them to reduce and eliminate our kind of crime that we have seen. That's the kind of work that I'm going to be doing.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Ventura, we're talking about handgun permits. Do you believe the controls now in place are just right or too tight?
Well, I believe this. I believe we need to take the subjectivity out of them and make them objective. Let's put the standards up there. If you qualify, you should be entitled to. It's interesting because if we back up to Wednesday night, we had a little mishap at my campaign headquarters down in Minneapolis. Would that qualify me to protect myself? Could I go get a permit to protect myself? Well, imagine this. When I was mayor of Brooklyn Park, I was riding with my police officers. I went to get that permit and was turned down. The mayor gets turned down. Now, you know, again, if you qualify, and this is what I believe, you can make it stiff standards. I propose a gun training course. I also want someone to pass a minimum marksmanship course, no mental problems, no convicted felons or anything like that. But you have the right to protect yourself. Police are reactive. They are not proactive. How many police officers stop crimes in progress? 30-year veteran might tell you once or twice, and if you ask him how, he said, I was lucky. I turned the right way on the street.
Okay, thank you. Jeff, you have our next question, which goes first to Mr. Humphrey.
Okay, Mr. Humphrey, I'd like to ask you a question that was brought up when we were in Brainerd for a debate, and still trying to get a concrete answer on it, I guess. In 1992, the state made a $315 million loan to Northwest Airlines. Northwest's end of the bargain was that they were going to build a facility here in Duluth that would employ 1,000 people, also employ 500 people in Hibbing with a facility. That was supposed to happen by 1996, and driving up to Duluth today, I didn't see any Northwest Airlines sign make my way into town. I think most Minnesotans are perplexed at where has this $315 million gone, and what can be done to make Northwest hold up their end of the bargain.
Well, driving up to Duluth today, you probably wouldn't have seen much of anything, given all of the fog. But the reality is that that commitment was made, and now we need to make sure that Northwest Airlines fulfills its commitment. And one of the key things that a governor can do is to go back and talk with the corporation, with the business people, and to say, what are you going to do? Here is what you made. Here's the agreement you made. Here is what the people of Minnesota contributed to see that you were going to be able to succeed. Here is what your workers and employees did. They've kept their part of the bargain. What are you going to do? And frankly, I'll be working not only with directly, if I'm elected your governor, with the company, but I'm going to be talking with Mr. Overstar, who has an awful lot to say about the airline business in this country.
Mr. Humphrey, I'd like to just follow up on that. As Attorney General, isn't there something that you could have already done?
We have already taken direct action in visiting and in signing, along with several other attorneys general, to demand that Congress investigate these efforts and to make the kind of changes that need to be made. So we've already taken that kind of action. But an awful lot of what the airline industry is involved with is regulated extensively by the federal government. So we need to partner strongly with our congressional delegation and, frankly, with the leadership of Mr. Oberstar to see that we fulfill these contract obligations.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Ventura.
Same question. Jesse, $315 million, and here we are 2 years past the date of 96 that this deal was supposed to be done. And I don't think anybody's employed up here by Northwest Airlines right now, at least not in those numbers.
Well, Jeff, I think what you have here is a classic example of corporate welfare. And I'll say this, my two opponents, you're going to see a rise in welfare. One, social welfare, with all the promises being made on the social programs. My other opponent, corporate welfare. And I believe it comes back to campaign finance reform again. That's the only thing I can figure out on this, is that, you know, it'll be payback time at some point in time when you're taking money from big wigs out there in the industries and all that, and they're footing the bill for you to become where you're at. I think that could very well be what we're facing right here. I definitely would try to hold them to their agreement, absolutely. We need the legislature to hold them to their agreement, because it took the legislature to agree to do this in the first place. The legislature must be held accountable to make Northwest come through with their end of the bargain. It can't be any of this anymore of one side doing it, the other side not doing it. We've got to get the legislature again to make them hold up their end of the bargain and do what they're supposed to do.
Is there any chance that you could get that money back?
Could I get it back? Well, I don't know. I'm open to a suggestion if you have one. You know, maybe lock me in a room with the head of Northwest Airlines, and maybe it'll be just like when I went to Washington to get that $11 million for that highway. I came out with 37 on the deal. So I might get us more back than what initially they wanted to do.
Mr. Coleman, what about you?
First, Jeff, I have to note, Skip, contrary to what you just told Jeff, the action with other AGs had nothing to do with Northwest fulfilling any commitment in Duluth. You haven't taken any action in that regard. That really goes to the issue of competition. And in fact, Minnesota didn't join when a number of other states sued, brought litigation. We didn't pursue that. Jeff, there is, by the way, a ticketing operation up, I believe, in the Chisholm area, in the Iron Range. And so there are jobs up here.
Right.
So there has been not a full commitment. You talk to the folks in that community, they're pretty happy about those jobs. I think what you got to do is you got to sit down and you got to make sure that commitments are fulfilled. But you can't just not look at one piece here, look at what's been done, and say you've got other obligations and get them done. Part of it is how you structure the deal up front. Structure it so that you have some, so, you know, so that you can take some action, so you're not left with yourself handcuffed when it's done. I will be the kind of governor who will make sure that we get it done right, and if we have to go back and revisit, I will be there to do that. But nothing's been done to date.
Are we not running into the situation also, though, as the years go by, it's only going to get more expensive and that money's going to be gone?
Again, Jeff, I think you got to look at what's been done, weigh the value of that to the community, then figure out what the obligations are and figure out if there's any way that you can meet that. I do have to say this. We do want a strong Northwest Airlines. We want competition. But you want Northwest Airlines. They're one of the largest employers in the state. So you got to figure out a way to keep one of the largest employers in the state, make sure that they're vital and vibrant, because a lot of people work for them, and at the same time, make sure that their commitments are fulfilled.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. We have time for one more media panel question, and it's yours, Jim.
Thank you. I think I'm speaking to Jesse Ventura first. Question to all of you. I just can't help but notice that all of the gubernatorial candidates, all of the lieutenant governor candidates, and for that matter, everyone on this panel is white. I'm just wondering, what would you say to a minority voter, African-American, Hmong American, Native American, to convince that voter that you have their best interests in mind? And do you support specific programs, specific dollars to deal with the unique problems that minority groups face? Mr. Ventura?
Well, I support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Minnesota, which I hope indicates that we all are equal and should all be treated equally under that Constitution. I think my best method of being able to explain that is, again, going back to my military background. When you're in the military, you work with every race, creed, color, and nationality, and it doesn't come down to any of that. It comes down to, can you get the job done, and that's how you respect each other. And I think that the honesty there will show forth for me that they realize that being a person in the private sector who has had a variety of careers and dealt in many, many ways throughout my 47 years on this planet, that I think I would just simply say that they should trust me that I will treat everyone equally and fairly. And to me, it's qualifications qualify you to do what you do.
From the same position, how does treating them equally, how is that fair?
Well, we certainly need to step forward, and in fact, taking the Hmong, for example, we need to step forward and help them. As you see, I wear an MIA bracelet. Well, I think the Hmong people are much like those MIAs. They came to bat for our country in a war that was hidden from us. We were not told about this war. They are now refugees here with a slow start, and we need to help them, absolutely, to get them on their feet. They're hardworking people. They want to be in the United States. They want to be Americans, and they are. Then they will be that, and we should try to help them as best we can.
Mr. Coleman, in what cases, if any, would you support using general tax dollars to help the specific smaller groups of Minnesotans?
First, Jim, I come to you as the mayor of one of the most diverse urban centers in the state. And when I work with and do work with on a daily basis among citizens, African American, Chicano, Latino, what they want what everybody else wants. They want job opportunity. And the way you get job opportunity is what I've done in St. Paul. You cut taxes, you cut regulation, you bring jobs. Then you do some additional things, but it's not a matter of guaranteeing anybody. It's not a guarantee. You bring people to the table. We have formed some unique partnerships in the construction industry where there are lots of jobs now. And we have worked then with the major contractors and minority contractors. But again, what you do is you give people the opportunity to come to the table. You don't guarantee results. You just guarantee opportunity. We've done that. In addition, the last piece is look at the diversity, even with my own office. African-American chief of police, African-American city attorney, the first woman labor negotiator, first woman public works director. So what you do is there's diversity around you, but in the end, it is giving people the opportunity, not guaranteeing the results, and finally, make sure you got jobs, jobs, jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman.
And Mr. Humphrey, what kind of emphasis would you put as governor on helping minority groups?
First and foremost, in order to succeed, you have to have quality education. You need a good, solid public education system. And as I said, you need to start even before K through 12. That's what's most critical. That gives you the ability to train those God-given talents that every citizen has. Secondly, though, we need to ensure that there is opportunity for all of the citizens, those that are new, those that have been here a long time, and others, in the private sector. And I want to see and ensure that we have that full opportunity with our small businesses and to expand the opportunities there. Within the government ourselves, I can tell you in my own office, at the highest possible levels, we have had members of a lot of different minority groups that have given us the kind of training and the kind of leadership that allows me to do the job that I've done in the Attorney General's office. We need to bring that all the way across state government. And I will have an open door, as I have visited with Chicano Latino, with American Asian, and along with so many of the other Native American groups. We need to make sure that we have a fully representative government.
Your time is
in
up.
Our state.
Thank you, candidates and media panelists. Let's give our studio audience their first opportunity tonight to get involved right now. Our first question comes to us from Mr. Eric Peterson, representing AFSCME and the Corporate Subsidy Reform Commission.
Thank you. Last year, the Bipartisan Corporate Subsidy Reform Commission made a series of recommendations to the legislature, which would require more accountability for businesses receiving subsidies. They also recommended that all businesses receiving taxpayer subsidies be required to pay their employees at least a living wage of no less than $8.50 an hour. As governor, would you support the commission's recommendations? And specifically, would you support requiring businesses that receive taxpayer subsidies require them to pay their employees a living wage?
Mr. Coleman, that question goes to you first.
I think the best way to get a living wage is to promote job opportunity in this state. And right now, that's probably a non-issue. In the city of St. Paul, it's just about a non-issue. In fact, that there are so many, when there's so much demand for work, for jobs, you don't need to impose artificial wages. Living wages come from having high-tech opportunities. In the city of Duluth, they have an information technology village that they're being created. I think the best way to get there is not by government-imposed mandates, but by simply doing those things that create opportunity to bring high-wage jobs here. We have that in the timber industry. We have that in the mining industry. We have that in the information technology industry. And I think we need to keep moving in that direction. If we do that, that is the best hope of guaranteeing livable wages for all Minnesotans.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Humphrey, do you need that question rephrased?
Well, I think I understand what the base of the question is. When we have public contracts, I think we ought to require that there be a living wage. And to the extent that they are not met, I think there ought to be a response back that says, well, if you're not going to meet those kind of commitments, then we ought to have that dollars back. So I would tend to agree with the commission's report. But I also believe that the way in which we can ensure that we have a living wage, not just in public contracts, but all across the board, is to have the solid foundation of education, to make sure that we have the best trained workforce. That will attract the quality jobs that we want to have. Those jobs are high-wage jobs. In the information area, for example, they're very high-wage jobs. So we want to make sure that we have that. That gives us the opportunity in a free marketplace to go even beyond what is called a living wage. I want to see a successful wage.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Ventura?
First of all, subsidies. There you got government getting involved again, subsidizing something. And I want to be very clear and make it clear to everyone out there. When government gives someone a dollar, they took it from someone else. Government does not create any money whatsoever, and the chances are they took $2 because they kept the dollar for themselves before they passed on that dollar. Now, I think that absolutely that there should be negotiations on these contracts, and let's do it out front on the negotiating end maybe. As people bid for these government contracts, maybe as part of their bid, it should also state what they're willing to pay and what they pay their workers to work on that contract. And that way the government can judge accordingly at that point in time on the bids that they receive from outside enterprises and the work that they're going to do. Let's get it out front and above board before it happens, not after it happens.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Our next audience question comes from Rosie Leffler Kemp, representing Clean Water Action and the League of Women Voters Natural Resources Committee.
Okay, would you support the temporary suspension of large-scale livestock feedlots in Minnesota? Why or why not?
Mr. Humphrey, the question goes to you first.
I do think we ought to have a temporary halt to the largest of the feedlots while we get the information from a GEIS, a generic environmental impact statement. Once we have the understanding of the impacts, both ecologically, economically, and socially within the economy, then I think we can move forward in a way which will provide sustainability, which means that we have the opportunity to continue to grow the industry and yet preserve the qualities of our living that all of us like and love, frankly, about Minnesota. That's what is most critical, is to get it right. The perfect example of this is the logging industry up here in the Northeast, and to see the kind of changes that have taken place under a voluntary agreement between environmentalists, loggers, and the forest industry itself. That kind of combination of effort has moved us well beyond just the command and control of regulation. In fact, it's given us opportunity to have a greater annual harvest and at the same time to grow the base of the trees and the forest that will preserve for the future that kind of industry.
Your time is up. The question goes next to Mr. Ventura.
Yes, I do support a temporary moratorium on it. I think currently we're being sued right now by the state of Iowa because one broke down there, got into the water table, flowed into Iowa, and now we got lawyers involved. We don't need any more lawyers involved. And I think I'm not a scientist, so naturally before I could ever make a decision on this, I would like the scientists to determine at what level and what impact these feedlots have. And why are the feedlots occurring in these large scale? Well, I'll tell you why. Because we're not supporting the family farmer like we should. We're not supporting the guy who's actually out there working the land. Instead, the people that are getting the benefits more so are absentee landowners, which I think you'll find many, many of these large feedlots fall under that of being an absentee landowner. I want to make sure if breaks are going to be out there for the farmers, they go to the guy who's actually working that farm and is earning a direct living of supporting his family off of that farm.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Mr. Coleman, same question.
First, we have to deal with the environmental issue, and in fact, we're doing that now with the General Environmental Impact Statement study. That's happening. And we need to do, Skip, you're right, a voluntary cooperative effort. But not having government come in and saying to family farmers or farm families, you can't grow you can't join together. Now, farm families want to sell their product. If you put a moratorium on growth in livestock, livestock eat grain. It's the original value added. When you hurt the livestock industry, you hurt the grain industry, you hurt the shipping industry. Talk to the folks at Harvest State Senex who built a soy processing plant or building it in Fairmont. They tell you if there were a moratorium on livestock, they wouldn't be building in Minnesota. It's like it's a ripple effect. If we start putting government-imposed moratoriums, what we will do will destroy the farm families, destroy the economic underpinning of Minnesota, which is agriculture. A firm commitment to solving the environmental issues. But let's not have government in telling farm families that they can't join together and they can't grow. That's what will put them out of business.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. We have another question from our audience. Our questioner is Portia Johnson, representing the NAACP Political Action Committee, and her question will go first to Mr. Ventura.
Thank you. Many feel that the current wording of the Minnesota anti-gang statute defines gang membership in a way which allows people of color to be singled out and harassed. As governor, would you support changes in the wording of the statute to avoid language which appears to be directed specifically at people of color?
Well, I can't quote it exactly, but if it's that way, yes, I would. And I've worded that way, and it's determined that that's the way it's worded. It should not be that way. It should be very generic, just dealing in gangs, because gangs can be, there's gangs of all colors out there. Certainly there are. So if it's that way, yes, I would support it.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. The question goes next to Mr. Coleman.
I don't believe it's that way. I don't think that the word gang is a racist word. I've worked in St. Paul with our communities of color to have very, very, very aggressive enforcement because they want gangs stopped. They want gangs stopped, whether they're white gangs, whether they're Asian American gangs, whether African American or Chicano Latino. If you can't have the courage to say we're going to put an end to gang violence, if you're going to use, as some have suggested, the phrase anti-group violence statute, I don't think you're ever going to deal with the problem. And when I talk to folks within my communities, folks within communities of color that may be affected by a gang, folks throughout St. Paul, they're not troubled by aggressive enforcement to stop gangs and drugs. So I don't see the need for the change. I think we have to be very, very aggressive in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Humphrey.
I'm more than willing to work with the NAACP or any other organization to make sure that there is no discrimination in our statutes whatsoever. But I have to tell you that we need to rid ourselves of street gangs, criminal organizations that are creating the kind of violence that we see in our lives. That's why I've called for a doubling of the gang strike task force. That's the kind of effort of putting cops on the street that are going to do the job to rid ourselves of this kind of violence. Now, that has to be done in cooperation with and coordination with community leaders and individuals in neighborhoods. That's why I've also initiated the weed and seed program, which weeds out these kinds of problems and seeds in the opportunity of housing and of decent places in which to live. Those are the kind of efforts, as we do this all over the state, we are going to see getting ourselves rid of this kind of violence throughout our state. That's a goal that I intend to see achieved.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. One more question from the audience is from Jill Godfrey, a ninth grade student at Denfeld High School here in Duluth. Mr. Coleman, you get to answer her question first. Go ahead, Jill.
Do you feel that the closing of neighborhood schools and the creation of larger schools has contributed to the increase of violence in schools today? If elected, what would you do to improve the safety of students?
There are two parts to that question. First, I strongly believe in neighborhood schools. One of the reasons I believe in neighborhood schools is because you're right, it's a safety issue. One of the most important things for any child in their education is to have an opportunity for mom and dad to be involved in that child's education. And when we lose neighborhood schools, oftentimes we lose the ability of mom or dad to get to the school. It's on the other side of the town. And so I believe very, very strongly in neighborhood schools. I think we have to deal and relook at the whole issue of forced busing. So in that issue, neighborhood schools are a public safety issue. Because if mom and dad is involved in that school, that child, one, has the opportunity for better education, and I think you create a safer environment. In addition to that, we have to deal with the issue of violence in schools very, very clearly, working closely with our police department, working closely with the community. Kids should be afraid of only two things, a teacher
and the next exam, but nothing beyond that. So we need to be aggressive, but neighborhood schools are an important component. I'm a strong advocate of neighborhood schools.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Humphrey, the question goes next to you.
Well, I'm a very strong advocate of neighborhood community schools. They really are the centerpiece. Each of my children went to our neighborhood school. All of the people that lived in our neighborhood always centered upon what was going on at the school. It does drive the kind of community connections that make all the difference, and it also provides then for the network that you need in order to have public safety truly on the neighborhood streets and in your community. But I think you also have to have the opportunity for choice, and that means whether or not it's a charter school or a learning center or a magnet school, we need to provide that kind of choice within the framework of the public education system. That will not happen if we do not support, by financial incentive and investment, additional revenues to see that our community schools are strong. You can't do that if you're going to be siphoning off the dollars, as my Republican opponent would like to do, away from the kind of education, the public education, that the vast majority of our students receive.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Ventura.
Well, I am also a product of neighborhood schools in Minnesota. I went to Cooper Grade School, Sanford Junior High School, Minneapolis Roosevelt High School, and I think I was the first to bring up the fact that we need to go back to neighborhood schools. And I'm happy that my two opponents have jumped on board because it's a great idea. And I want to do that because, again, when I went to school in the neighborhood school, you had strong PTAs. You cannot have that today when a child is bused 45 minutes to an hour across town when you have one working parent and all that. So by getting back to the neighborhood school, I think it not only serves the school better, it serves the community better. And you know what? The proof is in the pudding. I send my children to public schools. That's how much I believe in the public school system. And I also have as a running mate the only candidate who currently teaches in the public school system, a 40-year teacher, May Shunk, who is well-versed, and if you want to solve the problems of school, ask the teachers. They'll tell you how to do it, and that's what I've done.
Thank you. Gentlemen, if we stick to our time limits, we will have time right now for one more citizen question. It goes first to Mr. Humphrey and comes from Phil Enke, past president of the Duluth PTSA Council.
I would like to know your position on for-profit companies such as the Edison Charter School using public tax dollars to run public schools.
I think that where we use public tax dollars and send it to private corporations for public education, that's wrong. It ought to be under the control and management of a public institution like your school board. Now, on the other hand, the example here with your lab school is a perfectly good example of a charter school where it is under the responsibility of a school board, but we have the kind of new innovation that is very, very exciting. I find it interesting enough that when Edison Schools went down to Minneapolis and made application, they made sure that they were doing it right, and they are under the responsibility and the management of those dollars under the Board of Education in Minneapolis.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Mr. Ventura.
I think anything that deals with public tax dollars has to be under the supervision of elected public officials, because that is the only way that you can truly keep track and change things. If they're not doing a good job, you have to be able to elect them or elect them out of office, as the case might be. So I would support that if public tax dollars are going to a charter school, that it should fall under some form of elected government officials so that they can keep track of the public dollars that are going in there, because that is public money, and you have to be, you know, you have to stay with the, because of public money, elected people, not like the Met Council in the Twin Cities, where they're taxing people and we can't elect them. That's wrong.
Keep talking, I'm listening about public money and tax stuff. It's about kids' education. That's what we're talking about. The community of Duluth it was innovative. The school was working with an opportunity to do something very innovative to help kids. That should be the final test of those kids learning. That's the same Minneapolis they've taken, again, being innovative. I support that innovation. You know, it's interesting, Skip, that you will support tax credits for college kids to go to elite private schools. And you can do that
but you don't support at the local, at K through 12, the opportunity for kids to have a true range of choices. We shouldn't be talking about the dollars here, the dollars there. One, we should have a full commitment to public education. But within that, if we create opportunities for better education for our kids, if every kid has the chance to have a quality education, then we're doing the right thing. So we should be looking at innovation, looking at options, looking at ways to help kids succeed. That's what it should all be about.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. At this time, we are going to take a short break while stations carrying only the first hour of the debate return to their regularly scheduled programming. We hope that this portion of the program will be helpful to viewers and listeners as they go to the voting booth on November 3rd. Thank you for joining us, and Debate 98 will continue in just a moment.